welcome to Healthy Brain, Happy Body, a podcast from the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. I'm Dr. Saul Rosenthal, a health psychologist in the Boston area, and your host as we investigate the incredible connections between brain and body. Welcome, everyone. Today, we are talking with Dr. Fred Schaefer, who is, of course, well known to the biofeedback and heart rate variability community. He had presented a webinar to the NRBS called HRV Tips You Can Add to Your Practice. And he's joining us to talk a little bit about those and go a little bit further into at least a few of the details. So Fred, welcome back to Healthy Brain, Happy Body.
Thank you.
So you've taught heart rate variability biofeedback for a long time. And most of us think about slow breathing and resonance frequency of breathing, of respiration, when we think about heart rate variability training. But in the webinar, you talk a lot about slow-paced muscle contractions as an alternative to slow-paced breathing. Yes. What led you to start looking at that?
The groundbreaking work by Evgeny Vashilo and his colleagues at Rutgers, where they demonstrated that you could achieve at least as robust oscillations in heart rate as with slow-paced breathing. Mm. And what made this important was that for some individuals, slow-paced breathing is medically contraindicated because part of their rapid breathing, their over-breathing, is designed to expel CO2 to maintain what for them is a very fragile acid-base balance. Mm-hmm. And so if they slow it down conserve more CO2, they could harm themselves. And so these are cases like some cases of asthma, COPD, diabetes. And while this is not common in our clinical practice and certainly in performance work, we need to be aware of it. Mm-hmm. And so this provides those individuals with a plan B that will increase heart rate variability without jeopardizing their very fragile homeostasis. Then there are individuals who, because of, say, chronic pain, find it very difficult to breathe more slowly. Now, mm-hmm. chronic pain is a subject that you know very well as an educator. I listened to a delightful part of your BFE workshop a few years ago. So these individuals may find it hard to get below 20, yet we're asking mm-hmm. them to breathe perhaps from 3.5 to 7.5 breaths per minute. Then you have people who have severely dysfunctional breathing, and it could take weeks to months to get them to breathe functionally enough and slowly enough to benefit from heart rate variability training. Mm. Okay, then you have people who still need work on their breathing and could benefit from using slow-paced muscle contraction as another cue to slow their breathing. And so this is a case where you can combine the two. So it isn't always either or. Mm-hmm. And there are many of my colleagues who are clinicians, and just a reminder that I am an academic and I don't see patients. It's from their experience, this may actually help the clients master slow pace breathing more quickly and also may help improve the results of their slow-paced breathing.
Okay, so there's a lot of really good reasons to do that, and I actually want to explore some of those a little bit more. But before that, can you sort of give the, I guess, the elevator pitch of why, of sort of what the procedure's like, and then we'll go into a little more detail about that as well.
It's like slow pace breathing. You use the same pacer. You are sitting in a reclining chair, ideally, with support for your legs. You are crossing your feet at the ankles. And instead of breathing slowly, you can breathe at any rate you want to breathe. Your task is to, when you would normally start your inhalation, you start your contraction. And it's a very, very gentle contraction, perhaps 25% of maximum effort. And what you're contracting are your wrists, your abdomen, your core, and your ankles. Okay. You're doing that simultaneously. And so you contract them for the time you would normally inhale, and then you relax them for the time you would normally exhale.
Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring up a video of the procedure that I'll ask you to talk us through. And for those who are just listening, who just have the audio version, I'll include a link to the to the video for you to watch as well. Okay, so.
So here we are looking at my lab manager, Emma Suchland, and we're using another version of this technique in which we're following a pacer, and instead of contracting during the entire length of the ball's movement along the upward part of the pacer, Emma's going to contract for 1.5 seconds before it reaches the peak.
Okay, let's watch that.
Okay, and so then she is going to start relaxing. So she's going to contract 1.5 seconds before. She's going to continue till 1.5 seconds after, and then relax the rest of the time.
So it's a pretty simple procedure.
Oh, yeah. Extremely simple. The reason I have suggested starting the contraction at the time that you would normally do your breathing is it just may be simpler for some people.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly if you're trying to combine contraction with breathing, it makes sense to start them and end them at the same time.
Right. So you can contract for, say, the length of the whole breath, but here she's not.
Yeah, exactly. And in all of our research, we've done it with basically 1.5 seconds before the peak to 1.5 seconds after the peak. And we have seen robust increases in HRV that easily rival what you can achieve with slow-paced breathing.
And that's even without doing the contraction for the entire cycle?
Exactly.
Huh. So that's actually really interesting.
And it's only about 25% of maximum effort. Now, you might ask, where did we get the 25%? And the answer is it had to be sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
And we want a nice, smooth rhythm. And it's analogous to the way our dear colleague Ina Khazan describes breathing. Breathe as if you are smelling a flower. And very consistent with another longtime colleague and mentor, Eric Pepper's idea of effortlessness, mm-hmm. except in this case, it's effortless muscle activity as opposed to breathing.
So you've said that you're kind of exploring this in the lab.
Yes.
Have there been any findings that have surprised you?
Yes. One finding that surprised me was that slow-paced contraction actually does not result in warming the hands or increasing blood flow to, say, the temporal artery. And slow-paced breathing does at slow rates. And by slow rates, maybe 3 contractions per minute or 1 contraction per minute. So slow-paced breathing will produce that. It even will produce it at 6. But slow-paced muscle contraction doesn't. And I think part of the reason for this is it doesn't liberate nitric oxide. I think another reason is that even gentle contraction is still exercise. The way it produces heart rate variability is through a muscle pump.
Okay.
So that's speculation. I have no idea if I'm right here.
Well,
but what's clear to me is it doesn't cause warming.
I mean, it certainly makes sense, both of those explanations, and it reminds us of Eric Pepper always telling us that breathing is not heart rate variability, that there are other effects, and one of those being changes in blood chemistry that affect blood flow. So we tend to talk about resonance frequency around respiration, but you're also talking about it for contraction. Is it sort of the same thing as we would with respiration? Do we find it in the same way?
Yes. I can't tell you, there has been no published research on using a muscle contraction protocol to calculate the resonance frequency. So this research hasn't been done. If I live long enough, I hope our lab will have a chance to explore that. It is certainly in the planning stages. What happens, though, when you're building a research program, is that some things are on fire, and some questions demand that you address them right away, and other things you can put back in the future. We certainly have a design for exploring this. And again, Dr. Kazan's optimal HRV application, which she has consulted in its development, has a wonderful application for determining the resonance frequency. And it is agnostic with respect to whether you're doing it through breathing or muscle contraction, so that you can use their pacer and simply use the techniques that we've talked about today. So instead of breathing, you simply contract your muscles either during the full length of the pacer's upward run, or 1.5 seconds before the peak and 1 to 1.5 seconds after the peak. And it will calculate for you what your resonance frequency is. It doesn't care whether you are breathing or whether you are doing contraction. So that's an easy way to do it.
One of the things you sort of started talking about was reasons to do this. And there are conditions that suggest, you know, you don't want to play around too much with the oxygen carbon dioxide balance, and there's also which of course should inform us as those of us who are clinicians to be aware of what's going on, and also just some people just it's really hard for them to do, and whether that's because of the condition they're coming in with or for whatever reasons, what are for clinicians out there, what are some of the signs that they're clients may be struggling with paced breathing, short of them saying, I'm struggling with paced breathing, what should we be looking for?
I think the first thing to realize is that in many cases, research participants and clients won't be able to follow the pacer precisely. When I look at the excellent research that our colleague, Dr. Patrick Steffen, has published from his lab at Brigham Young University, one of the takeaways was that many times the research participants were a breath, several breaths away from the target. It's not easy to dial in. If you're a client, it's not easy to dial in. It doesn't matter whether you have serious dysfunctional breathing or you're just a otherwise healthy research participant. It's not easy to follow a pacer. I think we assume it is, and in that we're wrong. I think the way you as a clinician or a performance professional can check is using a respirometer. So that is a stretchy band around the chest or abdomen. And after a trial, see what the actual breathing rate was. Mm-hmm. In our lab, we do it in real time. And if someone is off by half a breath per minute, we will redo the trial.
Okay.
And typically our training is, and our measurement is in half breath steps. So mm-hmm. we need that level of precision. And so we just have them redo the trial. So for clinicians and performance professionals, I would invite you to check trial by trial and not simply assume that they nailed it because they won't have.
I think it's easy to make sort of I'm not sure they're contradictory assumptions, but I think we make these two assumptions. One, that breathing, respiration is sort of the key to everything. Mm-hmm. And that two, everyone can do it because we do mm-hmm. it 20,000 times a day.
Right.
And yet you're suggesting, well, if we're thinking about like heart rate variability, we don't necessarily have to rely on breathing. We have this plan B. Mm-hmm. Is there any reason that shouldn't be a plan A? That why not start with muscle contraction?
I think the reason it shouldn't be a plan A is that when you look at real-world practice, it's probably easier to sneak in stretches of slow-paced breathing than slow-paced muscle contraction. Mm-hmm. You can do it more covertly mm-hmm. In work settings and others. For example, when you think about the requirement of you need to have your feet supported. You need to contract your wrists and ankles. And if you are not trying to breathe at the same time, your core, that's very public. That's mm-hmm. you can't sneak that in the way that you can sneak in slow-paced breathing. And ideally, we want our clients to practice slow-paced breathing in many different settings,
right,
so we can generalize the response.
Well, regardless of how we improve heart rate variability, whether through breathing or through muscle contraction, what can we expect, say, 8 weeks later after we start the training? What can the clients expect? What is success, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Okay. One of the takeaways from my NRBS webinar was keep your eyes on the prize. The prize in this case is the reason you initiated training. If it was, if the reason was to see reduction in anxiety, better athletic performance, then focus on that. If the reason, the reason should never be a metric. Now, I'll talk about metrics in a moment, but I want to really emphasize that we should not chase metrics. We should focus on why the client has entered training. And it could be to deal with clinical problems or performance issues. And these we should monitor continuously. Mm-hmm. And that is what I'd expect to see a change in when clients are reevaluated at say, 8 or 10 weeks. Now, since we are evidence-based, we also would like to look at physiological data. Mm-hmm. One thing that should change within maybe 6 to 8 weeks is vagal tone. Now, we can't measure vagal tone or parasympathetic firing directly in most settings.
Right.
But we can use the natural log of high-frequency power when people are breathing at normal rates, like 12 to 18 breaths a minute, as a proxy. And so the natural log is just the log to base E. Mm-hmm. And so high-frequency power and its natural log should increase over time.
Okay.
Another thing we should expect when they're breathing at normal rates is we may see an increase in one of the HRV time domain metrics. That means just how much variability did we see in this measurement period of the RMSD, mm-hmm. which is widely used by so many applications, by so many wearables. And so the RMSSD might increase. It depends on your age. So if right. you're my age, you pray it doesn't go down. If you are much younger, you may see a small increase in milliseconds. So it might go from, say, again, we're talking about resting. You might go from 15 milliseconds to 18 or 20. But even that might not happen. So you look at the trends. You don't look at a given day's measurement. Again, keep the eyes on the prize. Mm-hmm. Have a way of monitoring the qualitative measures that matter most to your client. That will increase their buy-in.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes a lot of sense. And I guess it's because you sort of said in the webinar to use HRV as a compass, not a scoreboard. And I think
yes,
that's what you're talking about.
Yes. It's so easy to use it as a scorecard and also to compete. And that's just silly. It's probably part of our culture, but it is a silly part of our culture. Mm-hmm. If part of the reason it's silly is that there is a limited range in which we will be able to change metrics like the RMSSD and the SDNN when we're simply resting and breathing at normal rates.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very limited range. You're not going to move it a great deal. You don't need to move it a great deal. My greater concern is doing the things in everyday life that can support heart rate variability as well as overall health. And so what I mean by that are the levers that we can pull. Mm-hmm. Like, we can't pull the age lever. We can't pull the genetics lever. But we can improve our sleep. We can improve the amount and quality of exercise. We can get better at stress management. And if we do these things, at the very least, depending on where you are in terms of age and genetics, you'll be able to protect your HRV, and in some cases, you'll be able to raise it. Mm-hmm. But it's easy, as you are newcomers to the field, to assume that more HRV is better. And it doesn't work out that way, even when it's generated by healthy mechanisms. Now, it turns out that I have freakishly high HRV, but not for a good reason. Every now and then, I have a premature atrial contraction, a PAC, and that greatly inflates my HRV. So I don't get excited about seeing higher numbers. I don't want to see higher numbers because it most likely will mean more PACs.
Right. Well, you've been in this field kind of from the beginning, and I'm curious, as you sort of look back to when we first were talking about HRV and training it, what have you changed your mind about? What's different now than it seemed back then?
I am more likely to interpret some of the everyday changes that we see in physiology as vagal withdrawal, meaning a reduction in parasympathetic firing, than as evidence of sympathetic activation. This is a point that Stephen Porges has very capably made. And the nuanced approach I take to this is if you see hand cooling, if you see increased sweating, you're not talking about vagal withdrawal, you're talking about sympathetic activation. Right. But if you see a perhaps a slight or moderate reduction in HRV, then that very well could be vagal withdrawal. So you can have vagal withdrawal without sympathetic activation, although you can have both.
Yeah.
So you want to be nuanced. You want to be open to all these possibilities. And I think we've come to understand that there's a great deal we don't know for sure. It should lead to humility. And let me tell you what I'm talking about. We don't truly know what determines the resonance frequency. Mm-hmm. We know that one part of the apocryphal elephant is perhaps the trunk, if we're lucky, is the amount of blood in the vascular tree. Mm-hmm. We don't know how much of the total variability or the pie chart that explains.
Right.
There, if you do a deep dive in the literature on this, you really won't find a good quantitative estimate. So we don't know how to section the pie chart. I'm very sure it's not 100%. Right. Another thing that we're not sure of is, does the resonance frequency change between sessions? I think it does. I think it does somewhat. I don't think it does night and day. Let me give you an example. If someone's dehydrated, it means there is less blood. Potentially, it could mean there's less blood in the vascular tree. How much does that shift the resonance frequency? Maybe just a skosh. I'm not talking about from 7.5 to some horribly different number. Mm-hmm. But it could change it by a half or more, maybe. We don't know. My lab is the only one who has published data on reliability at 2 weeks, the test-retest reliability. Right. I'd like to see a larger larger clinical sample, because we don't have those data. I'm sure that there are labs that have those data, they just haven't published them. Mm-hmm. And so that's another thing we don't know about. All right, and that's one of the reasons that my dear colleague, Dr. Richard Gewirtz, has suggested that in the session after you've done a resonance frequency assessment, take that measurement, whatever it is, have them breathe at that, and then have them breathe one half breath per minute more slowly and one half breath per minute more quickly to see if we can fine tune it even more. Mm-hmm. In part, it suggests that there's imprecision in the measurement process, that even if the person's physiology hasn't changed, they may not have been consistently breathing at the rates that we had used in our assessment. So those are some of the things that have surprised me and have taught me deep humility, rightly earned. But also let me talk for a moment about the things that have caused deep appreciation. I am in awe of the landmark contributions that Yevgeny and Bronya Vashilo have made to the field. This is the foundation of HRV biofeedback. I'm in awe of Paul Lehr's scholarship, Dick Gewirtz's scholarship, and those of their students in developing the field. And I believe that this has the potential to make a significant difference in the standard of care for both medical patients as well as in standard of training in performance applications. And so I'm in awe of the impact that these amazing colleagues have had on our field.
Well, with that kind of is it actually an interesting segue to my final question, which is for clinicians or performance folks who are just starting out, What's sort of one thing you would have them consider when they're thinking about trying to train HRV?
This I have rightfully stolen from Eric Pepper. And it's a real simple concept. Make sure you can do it. Make sure that you have mastered the skill, so that you can be an effective model. And my best go-to example of this is our dear colleague, Dr. Donald Moss. I have noted during many of our shared didactic workshops that Dr. Moss has freakishly warm hands. And I will ask him in the middle of the workshop, Don, could you tell our attendees why your hands are so gosh darn warm? Because typically we're in hotels and the rooms are fairly coolish, and it's hard for me to keep my hands above, say, 85 or 90. And Don, by now, is used to that question, no longer winces or recoils when I use the word freakish, and explains, Fred, as a clinician, I train kids, and kids will typically demand that you show them that you can do it. Mm-hmm. And so he had to train himself to that level of proficiency. So the takeaway is, train yourself to the level of proficiency you want your clients to achieve. That will give you street cred and make you an effective model.
Well, Dr. Fred Schaefer's webinar for the NRBS is HRV Tips You Can Add to Your Practice. You can find it on YouTube. Just look for NRBS, and I'll include a link to the webinar in the show notes. Fred, thank you so much again for joining us here on Healthy Brain, Happy Body.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Take care now.
Thanks for joining us on Healthy Brain, Happy Body. Subscribe to this podcast by clicking the Subscribe Here link in the show notes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy Healthy Brain, Happy Body, please rate us and leave reviews at Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get the podcast. Reviews help us reach more listeners, and that's more people who can learn about and benefit from biofeedback, neurofeedback, and other mind-body approaches to health. Also, let us know what you think by sending us email. Our address is healthybrain@nrbs.org. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is produced and edited by me. The theme music is Catch It by Coma Media. It is a production of the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. Go to nrbs.org to find out more about the organization, including our trainings, monthly webinars, and yearly conference. All opinions expressed are those of our guests and not the NRBS. This podcast is not meant to replace advice from qualified healthcare providers. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is supported by the sponsors of NRBS. Be sure to join us on our next episode as we continue to explore the keys to our well-being on Healthy Brain, Happy Body.